Can you say your name?
Polly Little.
So this is the Living Legacy Project, normally at the Birchfield Penny Arts Center, but today I'm at the home of Polly Little, and we'll be doing our interview today. Today is June 22nd, 2015. So Polly, thank you so much for having me over here. I have known Polly for many years in many different capacities, and I feel very comfortable in her home, and it is very nice to be out of the museum in the sunshine on a Monday.
Yeah. Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
And inviting me.
So the first question I normally ask is, what inspired you to want to be an artist?
I sort of came through the back door to a certain extent, because I had originally intended to become a lawyer. And so I was taking a few theater classes, French, history, lots of histories for that possibility of going into pre-law. And you could take any kind of general education requirement that you wanted to sort of finish out your full-time credit hours per semester. And so I took a drawing class, basic drawing, drawing one, it's called in some places. And I really hadn't thought much about being an artist because I had a older brother who was really very naturally gifted and could draw anything from the time he was probably, 7 or 8 up. And so I always thought of him as the artist in the family, which ended up not happening. And instead, he became a musician and construction worker, basically. But then after having this one class, I sort of fell in love with the whole thing and started taking art history courses, and then ended up taking painting one and design one and sculpture one and printmaking, intaglio, at that time in Missouri, etching and intaglio, and a little bit of silk screening. More design, 3D design, that kind of thing. Eventually changed my major by the time I was actually probably mid-sophomore year to be an art major instead. And then really started taking even more of everything and lots of art history. Where both undergrad and grad, I ended up with degree, both sort of dual degree in art history. In Missouri, it was just an art degree at the University of New Mexico. My degree was painting and drawing with an emphasis or minor in art history.
Wow.
Yeah. Awesome. Too many different medias. I think that was one of the difficulties, is I tried everything. I tried sculpture, ceramics, and I was really good at ceramics. And then they moved the ceramic building to a couple miles away from the main campus, and so that kind of fell away. And it was harder and harder to get into the courses because so many people were taking it.
Uh-huh.
But it was fun.
Do you find that your background in art history has influenced the way you approach your art?
I think it has. I don't know that it's always in a positive manner, because one of the things that I find interesting today when I speak to a lot of the younger artists is I'll mention historic, like Caravaggio or Vermeer, or even earlier artists than that, pre-Renaissance artists, and they don't even know who I'm talking about. And I find it kind of sad on some levels. But then on the other hand, it also, on some levels, frees them from history, so that they don't even know that they're re-examining the same sorts of subject matter and styles that have occurred maybe hundreds of years before their time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But maybe that's a good thing on some levels. That's something that I wonder about now and then, particularly when I see a lot of shows working at Hallwalls Contemporary Art Center. Of course, every 6 weeks it's a different show. But it's like I've seen so many exhibitions over the last 30 or 40 years of brown boxes. And everybody who does it thinks they're the first person who's done it. And I find it curious at a certain point.
Yeah.
But usually there's a little bit of a twist that makes it a little different than the last show I saw with brown boxes. But it gets a little bit old after you've seen so many different art in different cities and by different artists that are so similar, and yet somehow it's accepted by the art world and promoted in specific cases. that's one of the larger mysteries for mm-hmm. me, is figuring out why certain artists become that 0.1% that actually sells art and live on their art. And so that's it's one of those things I don't know that anybody will ever figure out.
Well, you don't hear about all the ones who can't.
That's right.
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 That's the other side of it.
That's
and
true.
And I find, too, I was talking to Tom. We have a mutual friend, Tom Holt, who's been part of the Living Legacy Project in 2012, who was a part of the Living Legacy Project in 2012. And he was, what was he doing? Well, we were having a conversation about, like, if it helps to know what other artists, even, you know, within the same moment, are working within a similar style or not. Because in some ways, it's like, once you know somebody's already done it, some people lose the desire to do it. You know?
Exactly.
So sometimes the blinders can be intentional.
Right. Yeah, I think that that's very true. Oh. And it maybe allows more freedom mm-hmm. to the people who don't know that history that mm-hmm. we were just talking about.
Yeah, for real. So you mentioned it lightly when you were talking about how you've gotten to where you are, but where did you go to school?
I first went to Missouri Western State College in St. Joseph, Missouri, home of the Pony Express. And it was it's a four-year, one of the major, you know, one of the five or six major schools in the state of Missouri. And it had a pretty wide-ranging art department with professors from there. I think there was only one out of about 20 professors that was actually from the area. Mm-hmm. Most had come from elsewhere. Very few from the far west or the far east, but all over the Midwest, pretty much. It was fun. It was good. It was good for undergraduate degree. And actually, that's where I met my husband, so that was good. And then we moved to Albuquerque together, so that he had decided, after having taught art history for several years, that, or not several, probably about 4 years or five, that he would really prefer to be a painter. And he had been painting the whole time that he was studying art history, and had taken a few painting courses at Cornell and places like that. But we decided it would be a good thing for our relationship as well as our art to go to grad school together out at Albuquerque, New Mexico, at the University of New Mexico, right on Route 66, Central Avenue, which was a huge school, and had, during our time there, our 4 or 5 years there, had actually built a giant new fine arts department with all kinds of terrific facilities. And anyone who was a grad student also was ended up becoming a teacher of the freshman classes and or one of two I guess you can't really call them interns. They were really adjunct teachers who were grad students, and it would be one full-time professor and two grad students who would teach the weed 'em out class, as we used to call it. And it was mandatory, 2 semesters of introduction to art. And in that course, they would do drawing, design, all two-dimensional, but they would have different media about every third week or so. And that really did weed them out and got the kids who weren't really serious, because they would flunk. Nobody had hesitations about Fs back then in that day, in the late 70s, early 80s. And I loved New Mexico, loved the climate, loved the history of the state, the mountains. We did a lot of hiking in the mountains and some plein air painting out, and we would actually tie canvases to the back of our station wagon and use that as an easel, or I would actually usually work a little bit smaller and just use an actual easel and really haul all this stuff up to Huantabo, which was sort of the base of the mountains there in the east of Albuquerque. And so we had, you know, it was a terrific place. The only regrets is that we didn't buy something before it all became million-dollar mansions, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. We could have bought something for $17,000 or mm-hmm. whatever. But so we didn't do that, and instead went to New Mexico together. Both got our degrees, his in painting, and then he was there for another year, I think, for me to finish, because I needed to have a few more courses in the painting in particular, and drawing, to be able to finish out my degree. And so in 1980, we went to the College Art Association conference in New Orleans, and somehow Mark got a job out of that. I didn't. It was actually kind of creepy. Sometimes you would be interviewed in these different people's hotel rooms. which got a little scary when you were a single woman, 22 or something years old, you know. And so I was getting kind of spooked out. But I, you know, my husband had previous teaching experience, so he's the one who got the job in Dallas. We moved there, had both of our daughters there, lived there for about 10 years or a little bit more, maybe 11 years, and then ended up, Mark, getting a job here at Madai College in Buffalo, and that's what brought us here. And our big thing was when we made this decision to not stay in Dallas, that, well, at least there's the Albright Knox, Hall Walls, and back then, in 1980, Art Park was still pretty cool.
Yes, it was.
Unlike today. And then there was the Birchfield Penny. And I had always liked, actually, Charles Birchfield. They had a couple at the Dallas Museum that I had seen, and I was really intrigued by him. And they also had some in St. Louis, at the St. Louis Museum, that I had, and I was pretty surprised. I didn't realize he came from this part of the world. And no one in my family had ever lived north of the Mason-Dixon line, so that became a bone of contention for years. But that's long gone now. But we, because we've adjusted and at this point sort of consider ourselves Buffalonians after 25 years. Mm-hmm. In this crazy climate.
Uh-huh. I can't, well, and it's true, and I've always known that you come from all sorts of different places, but you're such a Buffalo staple to me. You and Mark, you know, you've been a big part of my world here.
Yeah.
I call you guys my Buffalo parents. Let's see. So, both as you were going through school, and you kind of touched on it with Birchfield a little bit, but who have been some of your most important influences, both personally, like as mentors or as influential artists who've affected your work? And that's saying a lot because, as we'll touch on later, your work has been
all over the place. All over the place. I think that's one of the problems with my career as an artist. But certainly my sort of number one all-time favorite would be Max Beckmann, who was a German artist who ended up having to leave Germany and ironically ended up, of all places, in St. Louis, Missouri, where he did some of his major paintings late in life and where the museum there has the best Max Beckmann collection in the United States. And then a few years ago, we were lucky enough to be able to go to Berlin, and the De Brucke artists in general, Emil Nolde, Kirchner, that whole group have always been influential for me. And then if I think about sort of more local influences, it would be probably one of my all-time favorite artists is Jackie Felix, who passed away a few years ago. But she had a, considering when she came to become a full-time artist, being a little bit older than most of us, she embraced it with no inhibitions, total abandon, and never cared about what anybody thought about her subject matter, which I had never really thought of as being as controversial as I discovered it was when the Birchfield did an exhibition of hers after she had passed away. And then probably my other most influential teacher would have been Garo Antresian, who was one of the three inventors of the Tamarind Lithography Institute in Albuquerque. And I was his TA for a couple of years, actually, my last 2 years of grad school. I was a print shop manager for him and did a lot of lithography. I did a little bit of etching when I first got there in Albuquerque under a woman named Jane Abrams, who was also quite exceptional, but one of those people who never quite made it onto the national scene, even though she was well-respected in the etching or intaglio world. But I think that those three are sort of the main ones. And then I also was really intrigued with, in sort of between undergrad and graduate school, with Helen Frankenthaler and her stain paintings, which I, of course, did some as a senior in undergraduate school, and then Linda Benglis, who had just come out, and for her undergraduate exhibition, she actually, I can't remember if she got the money from her father or what, but she actually got the front cover of Art Forum and placed a full-page ad inside that she paid for herself for her show, and that just shot her up into the stratosphere almost instantly, sort of her own self-promotion, and I found that pretty amazing. And of course, it was quite controversial, that Art Forum cover where she's got her blue jeans down to her ankles, sort of Vaselined up, pretty much nothing else on, and then has a about 24 inch or so long phallus that she's sort of doing this male interpretation of. In other words, I'm screwing the art world here. That's sort of how I interpreted it back there in the, about, I think it was 1976 or so, that that was the cover.
What was her name again?
Linda Banglis, L-Y-N-D-A. And she, still working today, she's in her 70s. Mm-hmm. But and she's one of those artists that lives in the Bowery, has for 30, 40 years, I guess, easily 40 years, maybe longer at this point. But she was originally from, interestingly, from the same town that Ron Emke's from in Louisiana. Can't remember the name of it right now.
I can't either.
But whatever, it's the same small little town.
That's so funny.
It is funny.
The world is so small
so
sometimes.
So small.
So Ron Emke is now part of the staff at the Birchfield. He's our Western New York artist biographer, and we'll be helping to write your biography page on the website.
Uh-huh.
But he was also a Living Legacy Project artist in 2012 as well.
Oh, good.
So, yeah, there's just always blurred lines at the Birchfield of, you know, artists and museum representatives, because
right.
there's just so many people who work at the museum are artists in the community.
That's
that
right.
we serve, you know.
Yeah,
and
especially the nonprofits.
Yeah.
And you don't see that much at the regular, you know, at the larger institutions like the Albright Knox. And if it is an artist, usually it's a preparator.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really see them in the more administrative roles
mm-hmm.
at the larger institutions.
Yep. Yep.
Unless they're perhaps doing work like you and Ron are doing with the archives or digital media
yep.
that are interviewing artists
yep.
for their promotional videos and so forth.
Possibly more musicians, you could say.
Yes.
Yeah,
yeah, maybe. Yeah, that makes sense.
Although I consider musicians to be artists.
So. Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Me too. That's true. I forget about that side of things.
Awesome. So we did touch on this. Polly has an iPad up that has a presentation that she did recently. Where was the presentation?
At Niagara County Community College,
mm-hmm.
where I had an exhibit in February,
mm-hmm.
a one-person show, which was the first time in a few years for one of those. Probably like 9 years, in fact, oddly enough.
How did it go?
It went all right. Yeah. It was a good show. I took some installation shots.
Good. You should send those to me as well.
Oh, I will. I will do that. Yeah.
So talk about your art. Talk about, and I know this is going to be the real meat of the conversation, because you have worked in so many different mediums. You know, what do you create, and why do you or have you created it? It's the best of
your Yeah, ability. It's one of those funny things. I thought about that a lot when I was writing my dissertation for my master's degree at University of New Mexico. And one of the things that I focused on was certain kinds of art tends to have this presence of spirit, is what I call it. And for instance, Eva Hesse is an artist whose work always had this very spiritual feeling about it, and made from this horrible material that most artists would not use today, because that's one of the causes of her death. It's this idea that I still believe that what makes one become an artist is almost unconscious, or from the unconscious part of the mind. And it tends to come from memories, dreams, and reflections, as Jung would have said, or thoughts is another way to phrase reflections, I think. And even though it sort of comes from that unconscious thing in the back of your head, to choose to actually make it and to do it, that's totally conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to pinpoint that, you know, like where exactly that comes from. I guess another way that I look at the process of making art is that every time you create these objects, I used to be an anti-object person, and I've kind of gone the other direction now, where I'm only making objects. But I see these objects that are made, like each painting, each drawing, each print, whatever media you're working in, is almost like a page of a diary that one might pull from somewhere. And then you put all of those objects together. They're like these frozen gestures that are actually describing your life as an artist. Whether it's conscious or unconscious, you're pulling on all of these experiences in your life. Like I have a couple of things that happened when I was very young. One was I had like a fort in about a 10-foot diameter lilac bush situation, where my father was like, do whatever you want with them, it's too big, blah blah. So I actually made like a fort inside the lilacs, and I could just be out there, nobody would know where I was, and I would just be lovely, and you would, you know, lie there and think about, look at the sky, watch the birds, the squirrels, animals running around. And all of those things influence whether it's non-objective art or more representational kinds of art. Every one of these memories and come from your younger self and somehow come out later in these art forms in one way or another. Another night was like, I called it Under the Blue Spruce. I did a whole series of drawings and a few paintings, mostly drawings back then, of that. And it was like the oddest thing. Nobody knew I was there, but I knew something weird was going on because we were all told to get out of the house or do whatever. And turned out, I guess there was something going on where this older guy was trying to get my brother. They were going to go to Mexico, and my dad knew that they were going to be scoring drugs and all this stuff. And so it became this like really insane thing to witness and hear. And so I was like underneath where you couldn't see me, under this blue spruce next to the driveway, with my father's chasing the car down the long driveway that we had, and finally catches up at the bottom and gets my brother out of the car so he doesn't end up in some prison in Mexico and blah, blah. And it was really sort of an overreaction, I think, on my father's part. But this was 1960s, uh-huh. And it was an odd time. Woodstock had just happened, uh-huh. And so the media was almost exaggerating what was going on with young people. And yet it was a wild time on another level. But it was like the same week that my parents had found what they thought was a rig on top of the refrigerator, and it turned out one of my brother's friends actually had to take insulin every day, and you know, and so there was all of these confusions. And so some of that affected some of my earlier work, probably mostly in undergrad. And then you sort of come back to that, and extreme experiences always stick, somehow become stronger in your memory history or something. And so the more traumatic things are the ones that tend to come out in the art. And then, I don't know, you know, once I've talked to other artists about this, and I've heard artists say things like, well, if you have children, you can't be an artist because they suck your brains out or whatever. You know, these crazy things that people uh-huh. think about that. And that always annoyed me. And so I've tried to keep being an artist in spite of the fact that I also was raising a couple of children, and it did make it harder, no question, to get the time and the focused energy, but no harder than having a full-time job and trying to be an artist as well. Mm. That's actually, I found, harder than it was to make art when the children were little or whatever, because they're off doing things too, and, you know, having a part-time job can somehow you're sometimes less invested than if it's a full-time job. Maybe that makes it a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. But being an adjunct teacher is like so little pay for so much work that's something I did for a while and sort of gave up about the time I started working at Hallwalls. I'm trying to think what else you asked here. Oh, the why. The why is the hardest part. It's like sometimes you feel like if you don't do it, there's something wrong with you, because you feel like you have to get this thing out, whatever that is. And having worked in so many different media, sculpture, ceramic, design, etc., I think I already went through that, it makes it seem scattered, and yet some of that can all be really talking about the same thing. Like a couple of the sculptures that I did had this more sort of pyramidal thing, again, not unlike that hiding under the blue spruce or hiding in the lilac bushes, that sort of wanting to see what's going on but not having to participate. That's something I think that I've done most of my life. Who was it? Nancy Grossman. And Nancy Grossman, she once said, do you choose a thing or does it choose you? And I have a feeling that whatever you become fixated on becomes your subject matter. And I have to agree with her. And being fixated on something, of course, means listening to what your eyes are telling your brain, or vice versa. It's something that somehow the meaning sort of surfaces from deeper inside yourself, and then you just got to get it out there one way or another. But having gone from non-objective to mostly images, paintings of people, and it was usually in social settings like art openings, picnics, vacations, camping, hiking, all of those sorts of things sort of start to creep in and become, and I started taking photographs too. I did a little bit of that too in undergrad, I forgot. But I started just using snapshots as basis for some of the artwork, and that like wow, I can save a lot of time here. I still continued to do figure drawing just on a sort of casual basis. I used to go to the University of Buffalo North Campus because they used to have a drawing night where you put in $5 or something like that and you drew for 2 hours, and I did that off and on over the last 20 years or 25 that I've been in Buffalo, and I haven't done it for a few years, and now I'm feeling like I got to do it again because that keeps you in touch with that drawing from life. Although recently, actually thanks to the National Garden Walk, I did some watercolors in our friend Elizabeth Licata and Ellen Bigelow's garden in their beautiful backyard down in Allentown. And that got me excited. And so now one of my goals this summer is to do some in my own garden, which I've never done. I whipped out just one a few weeks ago when I was in Chicago because of a show that was having to do with the National Garden Walk. And I wanted to have a second piece, so there was a possibility for one to sell. So I really like it, and I'm going to get back into a little more of that this summer. And then this transition from the focus on human beings and the interactions between people socially, mostly socially, not job dynamics, not the dynamics on the job or where you work, but more the social interaction of people. And I like it when people are laughing and having fun. I tend to use images like that. And really just about, gosh, maybe 10 years at most, I got more focused on painting animals. Ironically, almost more since I've been in the city of Buffalo, because when we first moved here, we moved to Williamsville, and then as soon as we could figure it out, we then sold that house and moved into the city. And since then, ironically, now that I have a tiny backyard and much less nature around me in terms of animals, we used to have like maybe 9 to 12 deers a day running through our backyard out there, and we'd see possums, and we'd see a raccoon now and then, and I even had a raccoon as a pet as a teenager. I did a little bit of some raccoon drawings recently and a painting of a raccoon, in fact. But so now I've gotten more focused on that and the wood cutting. I had been doing just straight wood cuts, and then I'd print them on paper and then do like a pastel drawing that was related to the imagery in the woodcut. And did sort of focused on that for 4 or 5 years. And then now, the last 5 years or so, I've been focused almost exclusively on painting. And just this last year, this last fall of 2014, I started to reintroduce the woodcuts again. And so now I'm excited about that, but I haven't. I sort of took a little bit of a sabbatical from my Hallwalls job to just work one day a week so I could sort of get my head back into the studio, which did help. But now I'm running out of time again to be able to get into the studio and get those going, although I did get at least 3 new big ones done for the show that I did at Niagara County Community College. I guess that's kind of answers it.
That's wonderful. That's a very good answer. You're great at this, Paul.
Yeah, but, oh, and I didn't really go to the... Oh, well, that's actually the next question. Mm-hmm. Never mind.
The totality of your work.
Right, the totality of the body of work.
I know. The next question's a big one, but it's big. Talking about, but life is big, and especially with you, you've done so many different things at different points. And so what I think is really wonderful, even for me, is that, you know, I'm most familiar with your woodcuts and paintings. You know, that's what I've seen in your home and in galleries and that sort of thing. And so getting to see some of the pictures you just showed me of, you know, your graduate work and your undergrad work and all these things you've done in between.
You're crazy.
Is awesome, you know, because in some ways, you know, wherever the point of reference is, everything else is like background fodder instead of...
Yeah.
Because we don't live in the fifth dimension, and so we can't see all
everything
points connected.
Right.
So talk about the totality of your body of work and different themes you've seen throughout different series, different decades.
Right. Well...
No pressure.
Yeah, it's like since we talked before we started the recording, I'm not sure if I'm repeating, but I studied sculpture, ceramics, drawing, painting, etching, and lithography as an undergraduate. And then going to graduate school at the University of New Mexico in 1976. I started to actually focus on painting after having had a few etching and, let's see, and lithography courses, and a little bit of art history, a little Baroque and sort of odd parts of art history. History of lithography by one of the foremost photography historians in the country who actually just passed away recently. But he was still teaching into his 80s. I can't think of his name right now. Oh, it's almost there, but it'll come back. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, so that's the one thing I didn't study there, even though New Mexico was kind of famous for photography. But so the reason I ended up opting to become a painting drawing major as a grad student was because a professor that both myself and my husband at the time had one semester came for a studio visit in my dinky little studio on campus and basically told me that painting was for men and that I should allow my husband to be the painter in the family and I should take up watercolor. And that's when I got very upset and decided I'm going to be a painter. This guy has made me so mad, and I just couldn't believe it that, you know, but there was also a anti, I guess they call it fabric art at this point, textiles, whatever.
Textile.
That it's called different things at different colleges and universities.
Fiber arts
is, I think, the most current one. But I asked about fiber art, and they just started laughing at me. They said, that's a craft. That's not an art. There were very hard lines, and this was, you know, I have to admit, this was the mid-70s. Like 76 to 80 or so, and there was still this ancient, well, what I think of as ancient at this point, attitude that different media were ranked on a different scale, painting and sculpture being at the top and everything else going lower and lower until you hit crafts, and then crafts were not respected unless it was sculpture made out of bronze or something like that, and then it's sculpture, it's not a craft. That was what did it. And I worked abstractly for many years in undergraduate school and graduate school, although I did a little bit of, you know, like I said, 3D design. I made chairs. I made all kinds of different projects that were utilitarian as well as aesthetic in different courses as an undergrad. But then figure drawing, like I mentioned a little bit ago, that's something that I try to continue to do just to keep the skills going. Because if you take too much time off from looking at something and then putting it onto a flat, two-dimensional surface, you get out of touch. You lose your skill. You got to rehone your skills, mm-hmm. I guess is how I'd phrase it. But anyway, so I actually, in grad school, I was really sort of deconstructing art there in the late 70s, early 80s. Actually, I guess it was the late 70s. It was 75, 74 to 80, where I was actually ripping and tearing, and I found a place in Albuquerque where you could go. It was an awning store that made awnings for people's patios and stuff. And you could buy it by the pound, and you get, you know, it might be yellow and orange striped or green or blue or whatever, because it didn't matter. Or it might be a solid color or a pattern. Didn't matter, because I was just taking it and ripping it and reconstructing it into this one series that was called Stations of the Cross, and they all had crosses in different ways, like the Russian Orthodox cross where the foot is always at an angle, sort of almost like a asterisk almost, but mm-hmm. not an asterisk, like a backslash uh-huh. or something like that, I guess is how you'd describe it. But anyway, so I did a whole bunches of those and actually sort of started that in... because I ended up actually getting a BFA and the master's at New Mexico since I just had the BA from Missouri. So I did one extra year to throw in an extra undergraduate course where I was a little more focused on painting and this deconstructing aspect of it. It was a lot of fun. I was teasing somebody recently that, yeah, I was doing Elizabeth Murray's before Elizabeth Murray, but oh well, she made it, I didn't. Then I sort of got tired of the way you had to store and roll, and actually a piece the BFA show had, this was also torn and sewn and awning canvas that had spray painted, regular paint, etc. And it actually was like a giant tent that went across the ceiling of the room, and then with gauze that went around in a spiral that you would walk through the spiral with bits of polyvinyl acetate and jute that was embedded in the polyvinyl acetate hanging from the ceiling. Mm-hmm. And with that piece, I sort of branched out into this thing that was like really brand new to me back in 1977, I think it was, which was this idea of environmental art. Although we had, at that time, the Ford Foundation was giving oodles of money to larger institutions to bring in visiting artists. Being in Albuquerque, every artist in New York wanted to visit Albuquerque, go west for a semester, or even if it was just for a couple of weeks. So we had Philip Perlstein, we had Harmony Hammond, we had Joan Snyder, we had Max and Joyce Kozloff both. We had, there were just so many people. Laurie Anderson, I was her driver. Mark and I actually, because our schedules were such that I was her driver one day, he would be her driver the next day, because a lot of us didn't have cars back then, but we did. We had a little station wagon, and so we would drive her out to these different pueblos and places like that for her to shoot film. And she was so much fun to play and work with for a few weeks. That those 2 weeks were like meant more to me than when, let's see, who was it?
Dennis
Oppenheim, who was there, and he did what he did at many schools back then, which is he always abducted, it seemed like, one of the undergrad women, and she would take off with him, and you know, it was like he was a real chauvinist pig, in other words. But I saw a lecture about him in New York. Actually, he was there, and he seemed like he had matured a little and gotten a little less odd over the years. Uh-huh. So that was good. But he was one of these that he wanted to pour oil down the side of a mountain. And so we all just went on strike and said, nope, nobody's going to help you, mm-hmm. because that's like environmentally stupid. And so I don't think that project ever happened, thank goodness. But let's see, the Station of the Cross. Oh, and then I did a series in the early 80s where I was still working, or started, had sort of gradually creeped over to this place of making more representational art, because what I wanted my abstract paintings to say was not getting across. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I started to, it's kind of like the, even the Stations of the Cross, even though there is a cross in every one of them, people weren't getting it. And so I sort of started with little vignettes on the edges and bottoms and or sides of paintings with little marks, almost like a chop that you would have on a print or something that was like your symbol. So I had a symbol for a mountain, and I had a symbol for this or that. And then it gradually, like, those became the paintings. And so that's when humans started to come in. And I'm trying to remember what library I was at, but I was at this library, and I was shocked to find that there is like 1,000 volumes of saints. I grew up Lutheran, the sort of anti-Catholic with a lot of the similar rituals, mm-hmm. but I had no idea that there were thousands of saints. I thought there were like 10 saints or 12, like the disciples, you know. And so I while my daughters were, you know, reading their little books in the children's section, I would be over there in the saint section just going, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. And so I did this series called Saints on Vacation, because I thought, what would a saint be doing in 1982 or whatever it was at that time, or 84? It was the early 80s. And so I decided, you know, St. Sebastian would be in Venice, California on roller skates, and St. John would be at the North Dallas Polo Club, and St. Matthew would be taking a dip in the mountain stream. And so I did a whole series of those, but I think three of them, plus a couple other paintings from a series right after that, ended up at my hairdresser in Dallas. Because in Dallas, you were able to trade art for services, which is one thing that I've missed. I traded art for tooth care, I traded art for hair care, and occasionally you could even trade art for, you couldn't trade art for food, you know, unless you were like a restaurant, not unlike what A.J. Fries does here in Buffalo, where he does a mural or something. I hadn't evolved that far yet at that point to even think of that, but it was fun.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so that was sort of unusual. I think Mark may have talked one dentist here into trading art for a little bit, but that was unusual. Every time I mentioned it to anybody in Buffalo, they thought I was making a joke, and so I would give up.
Man.
Yeah, it's a funny world.
I wonder if you could trade art for gardening work.
I do wonder.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of that one. Huh. That I don't know.
That might work. That definitely might work.
That's a possibility. I don't know. I don't really know too many people who do garden work. Most of them are corporations these days.
That's true. I don't know. I live with a bunch of hippies.
Well, that's like, yeah.
Like, I'll ask around.
Yeah. Yeah. Just come and dig. No. But anyway, I don't know. I guess that's...
That's awesome. I want to see more sort of the Saint it. Series.
Yes, so do I. I don't even know. I haven't. I still have a giant bag of slides that I haven't gone through because that's how we used to document our work. And I've scanned a few, but not a lot, that are now in a digitized format. And who knows? Hopefully I didn't paint over any. I am guilty of that. I have some paintings that are over decades, you know, like it used to be this. Well, that's still sitting around just taking up space, and I need a canvas, so here goes. I'm just going to take it and paint over it. And I've done that too often over the years, but then I probably have 120 too big, like white elephants rolled up on rolls in my basement that are just not being stored very well, shall we say. They're probably rotting. Sometime this summer I'm going to clean the driveway out and get them outside and see what's left.
You keep me posted, because if I'm around, I'll trade labor.
Yeah, it's really just, I just want to see if they've completely died or if they're still viable, but they're oil. They're all oil, so they should be okay. And you always roll the oil so that the oil's going in instead of out. No, you roll it so it's going out, so then when you unroll it, the paint goes together more. And so they're all rolled properly, because that's what we used to have to do. I mean, many people have made art that wasn't in a frame and wasn't on a stretcher that you could just tack on the wall. And I did a few years of that, too, which was great. Mm-hmm. And that's actually what I was saying to Mark. If I do get these out, I may just cut them and make them so that they just go flat on the wall instead of restretching. We'll see. It's one of my goals for the summer, find a weekend when it's not raining.
Well, maybe that's next possible weekend. Let's see. The next question I ask is about your creative process. And you can either focus on any specific avenue you want or do a broad breath.
Broad thing, yeah.
Good call.
I usually draw in a sketchbook before I start a painting. I guess I'll talk more about what I'm doing now, because that makes more sense. Usually do a couple of variations of a specific animal that I might be interested in. One that I try to get when I'm working with the animal imagery, I like to have the animal sort of looking out at the viewer from the canvas. And then with the woodcuts, though, I usually just look through lots of images of a certain creature. Like I did this one with a giant buffalo, because I thought, hey, if I do a buffalo, maybe somebody will buy it in Buffalo. And then I started thinking about where I grew up, St. Joseph, Missouri. And that was actually the sort of stopping off point for people before they went further west. And the town itself was built by a guy named Joseph Robidoux, spelled differently than Patrick Robidoux. And it was D-I-O-U-X, actually, at the end. But he was a poet and also came from a line of fur trapping traders. And so for some odd reason, my father and my uncle, whenever they would answer the telephone, of course this is back way before there were mobile phones or even cordless phones. This is dial it up with a actual dial, no push buttons or any of that, but they always answer the phone, bear trap and fur traders. And I never understood why. And then I started learning more about the history of this town. Of course, you always do that in wherever you live, in elementary school or 1 year of school. You're learning about your community that you live in. And I remembered a lot from back then, and then it finally started to make sense to me when I thought about it, because that's sort of how this area of Kansas City and St. Joseph, which are really quite near each other, and actually the International Kansas City Airport is closer to St. Joseph than it is most of Kansas City at this point in time, because it was moved further out away from the city of Kansas City, which makes no sense. Anyhow, so I decided, okay, that's what I'm going to do, because beaver pelts were the big thing. And so that's where I decided, okay, with the big buffalo, which was also a big trading skin, regretfully that we've, too many of us know the history of at this point, I thought beavers and buffaloes, that kind of goes together, and then I'm going to name it this thing that my dad and uncle used to say all the time, bear trap and fur traders. So that's one where I just looked at a whole lot of different images of beavers online, in fact, maybe a few in some magazines or something, but then I start to sort of build them almost like a totem on the woodcut part of it, so that some of the woodcuts, they're three or four different animals, but that's sort of the direction it's gone now that I've gone back to the woodcut, is actually taking one creature on the woodcut and just doing multiple viewpoints of that creature, in this case beavers. And so that's sort of the next place I need to go, is you know, thinking of whatever that animal is, and then I kind of start with that and then move on to other things like what kind of space it's in and whether I want it more shallow or more depth in terms of the illusion. And I'm not into making things look perfectly real, because having been a Max Beckmann lover, of course, his was a German expressionist style of painting. And it's a style that you don't see often in buffalo. It's like either it's super realism, or it's completely abstract, or it's photography. In many cases, of course, there's the installation people and that sort of thing. But when it comes to painting, you do not see a lot of gestural, more expressionist styles of putting the paint on the canvas. And that's the part I enjoy most, is sort of just letting it all go and slapping it on there, sometimes thicker, sometimes thinner, going back. There's usually a minimum of 3 to 5 layers on any area of the canvas, because you're sort of working out the not only the imagery, but the space that that's in as you're painting, and just using, in many cases, formal decisions, like I want something to recede or to push out in terms of color or value. I think value's been something that is almost harder to figure out, because when you work with a lot of color like I do, it's a little more difficult to get that higher contrast that you usually need. You have to sort of exaggerate it, I guess. And that's something that I've been working on more consciously over the last couple of years. Actually, after a long conversation with Tom Holt one night up in my studio about things. And it's like, maybe that's why I liked printmaking so much and still love the woodcut. I like the physicality of using that wooden mallet and these sharp tools to whack out the pine, which is mostly what I use. If I could find some balsa wood, I'd probably use that. It's never the right size, the balsa wood, so that's why I use pine as the for the woodcuts. And I usually print up a few, even when it's going to be something that's attached to the canvas. I'll print up a few to either use strictly as a print, or thinking that eventually I'll come back and use that in some other way with some pastel or other kinds of drawing materials on a work on paper. You know, the other thing, I usually have either some music on, or sometimes I just have the NPR radio on, and I'm not really listening to it, but it's sort of a background thing. It's like some people get into white noise. I'm not that fond of white noise, but I can, maybe it's because of the way our desks are placed at hall walls, I've learned to block certain things out, and so it just becomes this ambient sound out there. But the thing that I think part of the creative process is, not unlike something I mentioned earlier, where you use your own life stories or stories that you've heard from friends or at some sort of community event or just chatting with people as time goes by. That's sort of one of the starting points. You just have sort of an image in your head almost of something that you want to comment about or take into consideration, and then that helps you figure out which way you're going to go with what imagery. Mm-hmm. It's tough to say what that process is, because mm-hmm. it also, I usually use an ink pen to draw my initial sketches of any kind of paintings that I'm going to do, partly because it makes you almost free up a little bit because you know you can't erase it. And so you work maybe a little bit faster and you kind of do this outline, and that gives you already a sort of more graphic image mm-hmm. that might make it simpler to transfer onto the canvas. And I don't project onto the canvas. I usually use my sketches as something to look at to then make larger in on the canvases.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. No, that's great. That's totally great. Also, for people listening to this, as Polly was describing the piece,
Bear Trap and Fur Traders.
Bear Trap and Fur Traders. It's on the wall behind us, so I got to sit here and look at it she was describing the piece.
Right.
Oh, that's a nice pen.
These are the pens I draw with.
Really?
They're very inexpensive at Hyatt's.
They're beautiful.
They're like $12 or something.
Yeah.
And it uses...
And you can do the refill the cartridge?
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome.
I have turquoise, uh-huh. red, and green.
Uh-huh.
And I keep blue ink in the green one for some reason. Black ink in the blue one. And the red one just gets whatever. That one stays in my studio because it's taped together now. It has purple duct tape holding the lid together.
So you just have to trust yourself and not the pen color.
Exactly. Well, I use the blue just for work, for stuff at Hall Malls.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
anyhow, so I like fountain pens. That's one of my obsessions.
They are. They're beautiful. And they write so well.
Yeah. Nice and flowing kind of line. I know other people who really like the Pentels with the super fine points.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everybody has their little... Every artist I know has their preferred pen
mm-hmm.
and or pencils in some cases.
Yep.
Some people are pencil people. I like pens.
There was a pen Tom used to have that when it went out of business, he was just like buying them up everywhere. Oh.
That's what you got to do. That's why I have three, because I'm afraid they're going to go away.
Yep. I might have to get one of those.
Yeah, they're fun.
The next question I ask is some people roll their eyes at me when I ask it, and other people really have honest answers. And even Jesse Walp, when I interviewed him, he called
mm-hmm.
me a few days later, and he's like, I want to come in and re-record the question about what I want to achieve with my art. I've been thinking about it. I haven't been able to stop thinking about it. I know what I want to say now. And I'm like, okay. And it's not a high-pressure thing, but I do think it gives some insight into the artist. But what do you hope to achieve with your art?
Originally, when I sort of migrated into this world of the art world, as in been stated before, in undergraduate school and through a lot of grad school, as far as I was concerned, it was art for art's sake.
Mm-hmm.
There was, you didn't have to justify it. You didn't have to give a reason. You didn't have to tell a story. It was just art for art's sake. And that freed me, and I think many people of my generation, at least for a while, until it might not be really satisfying to yourself, and or you start to realize, nobody's getting what I'm doing here. And so when I was working abstractly, I think I mentioned this earlier, but I would get frustrated because people didn't, or the viewers would not get the references that I was making. And that's when I started to add these little boxes that were a little more specific, a little more symbolic, so that people could sort of recognize them. It's not like I was using stop signs or yield signs, but sort of more little abstracty things. But then now I guess my main thing is to get people to take a second look, to not just walk by in 5 seconds and say, oh, that's a painting, but to look at the actual animal in each painting and maybe have a relationship with that, or feel something for or from that creature that's in there. And for people to see the fact that these animals that we live with on a daily basis, even in the city, you find occasional raccoon or possum or whatever, something more wild than your dog or cat, which are everywhere. But to sort of see them as just as important as the human beings are. And that's for our own well-being. I mean, it's been proven over and over again how having a pet can actually make your life longer. I mean, I think about that when I'm walking the dog every day and all the other people walking their dogs every day It's like it makes you have to go outside every day with this dog so that it can relieve itself, take care of its business. And that makes you get out there and have this walk as well, where you get to see the trees as they transition from that dormant winter state to the little fuzzies and allergy season, etc., and then into the big leaves, giving us this great shade for the summers. And in fact, we just had some guests who were here, and they're going, "We're in the city of Buffalo?" I said, "Yeah, this is actually city." "Wow, this is like, there's not a street in Brooklyn that is as country as this is to be in the city, and how incredible that is." And I think that's one of the, at this point anyway, still one of the lucky things about Buffalo is that it has nature in the city. And with the Olmsted Park system, the Delaware Park that goes all the way down to South Park, I mean, that's something that we all need to appreciate. And that's where you're going to see hawks, or you're going to see, or hear maybe, not even see, but hear an unusual bird call, and Tiff Nature Center. And there's just so much around us that reminds us that we're not the only people on this, or people are not the only things living on this planet. And I guess that's sort of the more recent thought about what do I want to achieve. I mean, of course, everybody would love to sell art and make money, but that's, you know, if you can at least just have somebody relate to something that you have on the wall, that's enough for me. In a nutshell.
And you've done works of your pets?
You know, oh, yes. My pets, my children. I've done a few plants around, but
you'll start exploring
more of that. More of that
soon.
This summer.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
And so these next few questions, kind of the questions that it ends, that the interview sort of closes on, has in my mind like a couple different points. I always envision that the person who's listening to these interviews perhaps is somebody who's younger, somebody who's perhaps exploring if they want to go to art school, or if they're out of art school, what they're going to do with their lives. And also, the other side of that is also acknowledging the role the Birchfield has to play with Western New York artists' careers and production, and how, you know, we may not be able to offer a show to everyone, but what are the other ways that we can support Western New York artists and celebrate that? And so some of this is trying to help us figure out what the Birchfield can do better to help Western New York artists. So that's kind of like how these questions came to be included.
Right, right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
This is a difficult question.
Because the next question, what have you done personally to advance your career in the arts?
Right, exactly. And sort of in between, actually it's more like during grad school. I remember getting, you know, the portfolio together. You had these booklets with sheets of slides and your resume and maybe a few images that back in the day would be, you'd have to photograph separately with regular film and then print those up at some photo place or whatever. And so you'd have a book that had a few actual images and then a sheet of minimum of 20 slides of your most current work and all that stuff. Maybe some samples of exhibitions you had been in, but I remember going into New York City and trying to approach different dealers with my artwork, and it was like I felt like a roach. They were so rude, so mean. It was just sort of overwhelming. And even later at that point where I was working for this for-profit gallery in Dallas, I mean, I met Holly Solomon. I met Castelli. I met a lot of these New York dealers. And that's the only way I ever got my slides looked at by anyone in New York City, was to have had some sort of professional experience with whatever. They came to Dallas, I guess, one evening, and so I go out with the boss and her husband and Holly Solomon and Leo Castelli, and there was somebody else there. I can't remember right now. Actually, I think he was her assistant, and then he was at the New Museum after that. But it's like, that was the only way that they would even hold the slides up and then hand them to you and say, "Those are really nice. That's really great. You should keep doing what you're doing." And then shoved you out the door. And that was kind of my experience. And so I would enter these different exhibitions where you send them $25 or $20 back then. Sometimes it's $35, whatever, up to 3 slides, or now it's 3 images, 3 digital images, do it online, etc. And so you get in this group show here or this group show there. And I think after starting this more full-time at Hallwalls back in 1996, I think, was when I went full-time, I really got so busy with that, I was barely able to get what I needed to do done just for myself. Although, you got to send your images to people like Michael Beam at the Castellani, you got to send your stuff to Big Orbit, you got to send your stuff to Hallwalls, wherever. And there are usually certain policies that you can find online that tell you how to submit work. And it's true, 99% of the time it's going to be thanks, but no thanks. Mm-hmm. But that's life. That's what it is. And you can't make a result of sorry, not interested stop you from doing what you want to do. You got to keep doing what you feel like you need to do with your art, no matter what. Mm-hmm. And so you do. You keep going. One thing I did participate in was the NYFA Mark program, which also, because of funding, no longer exists through the New York State Foundation for the Arts, not the Council on the Arts. And that was in 2011, not positive, but I think it was 11. And that was actually very good. It taught you how to do, it taught a lot of things that I already knew, like how to do a budget, how to do a business plan, which actually I didn't know that much about. I learned about that in that program, as did several other artists over a 3-year period or 4. But my year was the last year, the last of the money, so there was like 22 of us or something instead of the 12 that had been every year previous to that. And so I think you had a little more individual attention, and maybe it was a little gone into a little more deeply in those first 3 years than it was the 4th year. But I still learned a lot. I had a lot of good conversations with fellow artists in the area, Western New York, including a few people from Rochester that drove here every third Saturday or whatever it was for a few months. And it was good, but there is this thing where you kind of feel like you're just banging your head against the wall at the same time here and there. But I did have a one-person show at Castellani. I've shown at Big Orbit before it was Big Orbit, back when it was Artist Space. I showed there a couple times. I've showed at some colleges, university. Local gallery like Indigo, which is really the gallery that shows my work the most. But it's always, I think the closest I've gotten, I think I had a two-person show there with Catherine Linder Spencer. But I've never had a one-person show there. But I've been in all the group shows there. And that's great. She once in a while sells a piece here or there. And that's terrific. And there are a few other smaller galleries like that. The new one that's going to be sort of a contemporary version of the Benjamin Gallery, called Benjamin Contemporary, that's going to be opening in a month or two, I think. They're still dealing with construction. Where's down on West Ferry, behind the church that was going to be the Upper West Side Community Center.
Yes.
That didn't happen.
But will now be,
I think, multimedia, yeah, performance, everything, yeah, kind of space. So it's like a little box of a building, mm-hmm, that's behind that. And it has a little separate driveway, but very little parking, so that'll be interesting, because it's tough already here, uh-huh, on the west side. You know, like, she's somebody who's already got, almost a stable of artists, and she's on our board at Hallwalls now, and Emily Tucker, and she's really good. You know, she's there to promote artists, mm-hmm, and of course to make some money, yeah, along the way, yeah, but there's also, you know, some underutilized spaces. And I've never been fond of the idea of pay to play, which there are galleries in New York City that you can do that. You can rent the gallery for a month, but you man it, you're there every day, you hang it, you deinstall it, you repair the walls, and it's almost kind of like a vanity gallery. And so I've never done that. I did have a friend who did that once back in the, I think it was the late 80s. Yeah. And they had to find a place to rent. And so they rented an apartment for the month, or actually for a month and a half, so they could get it installed and deinstalled and then haul the work back to Virginia where they lived. And it's an interesting model, but I don't think you get any respect with that. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to, it might help you sell some artwork. That's the possibility. Mm-hmm. And maybe you'll get some curators in to see it, but that's tough. It's a tough business. And so if you're in it to make money, I think, you know, there's so many little things that you have to do. Julian Montague knows the troupe or and how you got to do it. And it's all consuming. If you're going to try to go that route, you kind of almost lose a certain amount of personal time and space.
But he certainly has.
Yeah.
Certainly has.
Right. And so, I don't know. You know, it's one of these, I guess, before I worked at Hallwalls, I was also in a show there. It was the ARE grants. I'm trying to remember what that was called. Area Exhibitions. I remember. Regional Area Exhibitions. That's mm-hmm. what ARE was. And I know I did that before I started working there, so that must have been about 93 or 4, probably 94, probably the year before I started working at Hallwalls. So, you know, I've kind of shown a little bit at almost every place in Buffalo, so it's like, okay, I guess second round is a possibility because I do have a lot of different work than I had back 10 years ago when I did something mm-hmm. here or there. And then there's that little thing where I've always got a little something going on at Indigo. So it's a tough one.
What would you say? So you have a unique perspective of also working at a local arts organization, right? So
yes.
What are some of the things that, if you have anything you think you could offer on that, like what do you look for in artists for exhibitions? What do you know of John and Ed's process and also how you participate?
John and Ed, actually John curates every exhibition. Ed and I have no say in that. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the interesting things about Hallwalls. Mm-hmm. If you're the media curator, you curate the media. Mm-hmm. It is not the executive director. And I work more in an administrative way. But, of course, actually when Sarah Kellner was there, who was John's predecessor, I was much more involved with the artists who came, visiting artists, as well as with installations and things like that, because Sarah and I just worked together that way in a lot different way than I'm working with John, mm-hmm. because now I'm mostly doing financials and fundraising, and that's it. And when I was first there at Hallwalls, I was really just doing the QuickBooks and membership database, sort of. And then with Sarah, I added hours, and that's sort of when I started to become full-time by helping her get the installations in and up, and or, you know, I remember 2 a.m. helping sew together chairs that had been chainsawed in half so that you put the chairs that were chainsawed in half together with the other chair, and then you had to sew them. And I remember 2 a.m. with the needle still sewing these chairs together when the opening was the night after. And my poor children, I mean, Zoe was in installations, in performances when she was like 8 or 9 years old, having to wear a slip, walking around a trailer that was built inside the gallery in a kind of spacey way. And then my other daughter, Anna, was in Miranda July videos that she did when she was here, as was Ed Cardone's daughter, Flora. Of course, neither of us have been able to get a copy of that from the person who documented it, who's in Brooklyn now, but we ask every other year or so just to see. But so one thing I know is that giant packets with fancy covers and notebook style presentations is not what curators want to see. Send them an email with some images. If they're interested, they're interested. You know, it's not like it was in the 80s or the 90s. These are the beyond the aughts. We're now in the 20-teens, and it's digital, and you got to be digital at this point. If you're not, you know, nobody's going to look at your work, basically. And one of my bigger problems, because I don't have a lot of extra money, is actually getting professional images of the artwork, which is very hard to do. We do have a SLR, or a single lens reflex camera, so we can now do it ourselves, but lighting is tricky. My studio is sort of awkwardly, you can't get a nice depth on anything large, so I have to like take it somewhere else and take pictures of it or put it on the side of the house or whatever. But it can be done. But getting high res digital images is really important to go anywhere and do anything. And I think actually that's one of the things that, you know, when you talk about what are some of the needs as an artist that the larger community can provide, mm-hmm. that service of documenting people's artwork is a biggie. Because the better the imagery is, or the better the digital image is of your work, the more likely that you'll get something out of that, that somebody will give you a show, that, you know, that it can move your career along more quickly. And mm-hmm. I have learned the hard way about that, because I did have a pro back in Dallas that would do my stuff for me, and we traded, you know, again, I traded art for photography services, and that worked great. And since I've been here, I've been mostly doing it my own self, and, you know, trying to use a little dinky camera. Finally, we bought our daughter's camera off of her when she got a new one, and so now we have a decent camera that we can actually document our own, but it's still kind of tricky, and a pro is totally different with controlled light and all of that. I think that's one biggie that would help all the artists that don't have the photography skills. I mean, if they're a photographer to start with, that's, you know, that's a whole different thing. One of the other things that I think would be incredible is if somehow, some way, some institution would actually be able to bring in some curators from whatever, the Cleveland Museum of Art, maybe a few galleries in New York, but bring in some curators and have a day where they bring a couple pieces, or they bring their laptop with some imagery of their stuff, and you have a little one-on-one with these people to say, wow, you know, you should, I know a gallery that might be interested in you, you know, this, they deal with artwork in your vein, or up your alley, whatever, however you want to use that term.
Those are two really good ideas.
And yeah, those are the two that come to my mind mm-hmm. instantly. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, one would be, they're both would be incredible services for artists. But, you know, I know these people are also really busy, but if they got a free plane ride and a hotel room, usually they're, you know, they're willing to do a little bit of public service, as I would call it, you know, and so.
And that could be something too, where, I mean, what's cool about what the arts community offers in Buffalo is maybe you're not putting them up at hotel rooms. Maybe different artists in the community are putting them up at different houses like this or things like
right.
that. People
yes.
who have the space and have really lovely homes and things like that to, in some ways, like build community.
Right.
You know.
Right. And that's, you know, it's like I've hosted many artists here in our own house now since we moved to Buffalo. I did host a few poets and people like that back when we were in Williamsville in this tiny little house. But in this house, we've hosted, I don't know, probably at least 5 or 6 visiting artists that would be here like for a month or 2 months in some cases. Like Vokash, he was a researcher from Poland whose specialty was Paul Sheretz. And Rabanowski, I think is his name, because they worked in a similar way at the similar time. But Wojak, he was here and he was great. He was very sweet. I even bought a Polish-American dictionary while he was here and didn't help at all. He knew enough English that it worked fine. I'm trying to think who else. Kevin Jerome Everson, delightful guest. We had this crazy night where he said, there's a bat in my bedroom. And I said, no way. We've never had a bat in this house. And so he says, I'm pretty sure there's a bat in my bedroom. And he couldn't sleep all night. This was at 2 a.m. he woke up. So first thing the next morning when we're coming down to do coffee and stuff, he goes, I think there's a bat in my bedroom. And I go, oh, pshaw. And sure enough, I go into his bed, and there's a bat in the bedroom. So I have to catch the bat. I catch the bat. I put the bat in a box. He goes, can you, like, actually just catch it? And then maybe I can film it later. So I go, okay. So I caught the bat, got it in a box, kept it in the box because he had a lot of work to do that day. Fed it, you know, cantaloupe. It loves cantaloupe, bats too. So then I have this poor bat in this box all day. I figure, well, at least it's daytime and the box is dark, so things are cool. So then we go up that night and he gets out his, I think it was 8mm, super 8mm camera. And so I have to wrangle the bat so that it spins. It goes in an oval around the ceiling of my studio. And so I've got Mark on one end. I put a big hat and I said, and put a scarf around your neck, blah, blah, while you're in gloves in case. And then I had on leather gloves that come up to the, and a long sleeve shirt and a ball cap and thing in the back. And So I'm actually, because they're radar sensitive, I'm able to, I said, Mark, you're on that end of the studio, I'm on this end, and we wrangle the bat so it goes in this oval, flying around this room. And I felt so sorry for this poor bat. I felt abusing this bat. But nevertheless, we were able to let him go later that night. Just shot him out the window of my studio.
Look at all the art you've been involved in creating.
Well, it's true. It's been Skin In, the one where Zoe, when she was nine, whatever age, that she had to, she was this spacey daughter, so to speak. And Skin In was the name of it, because she actually, this trailer that she built, well, she's actually also somebody who, I think it was an accident, car accident or something that she was in. So she's in a wheelchair. And so we had to like put all these bars so she could act in this thing during the trailer. There were all these bars so she could go arm to arm to arm from one side of the trailer to the other.
Oh my God.
And stuff like that. And so,
so cool.
It was very cool. Yeah, I've helped build a lot of other artists' work as I think about it over the 20 years at Hall Walls. But it was fun. You know, I enjoyed working with most of these artists. Branding. Who was that that was branding everything? I think it was Maria Elena Gonzalez, who was also doing some prints out at Epic in North Campus Print Center. That I forget who runs that now. But anyway, that was pretty cool, and I missed that. But she's the one who put the tutu on the buffalo in front of the Fine Arts Center, a pink tutu, because she said, that buffalo just needs a tutu. And so she snuck out there one night and put the tutu on the buffalo and it made the paper.
That's so good.
It was very cute.
Even a student.
And so, yeah, some of these artists were a lot of fun. Hilalulu Lin from Jerusalem, she was fun to work with, although incredibly tedious. There were like 20 of us working on her project because we had to do almost 1,000 12 by 12 inch tiles with not over easy, sunny side up eggs. Her show is called Sunny Side Up. And so we had to stick this laminate on 12 by 12 inch tiles for days and days, and they all had to match up. So the entire floor, which was twice as much floor space at Trimain than where we are now, was all these sunny side up eggs. And then she made these little tiny narrow red hallways that you would have to walk down to see an image at the end of it, which usually had to do with a woman licking her thumbs or doing something kind of on the sexy side of stuff. But she was another very interesting artist to work with. Johanna MacArthur, also fun to work with, who did a video that it was our first time we had to like make a half circle on the floor out of plaster that was perfectly smooth. And then that was what her video was projected onto. So instead of a screen, it was projected from the ceiling to this rounded shape, half sphere shape, and it was all this video that she had taken out on the frozen lake of Lake Erie. And it was a long, involved, and wonderful process. This was back when we had the beginning of our HARP, the Hall Walls Artist Residency Project, and she was one of the HARP artists. And there are certain ones that were outstanding. Hilla, Joanna, and Kevin also, he was a HARP artist, Kevin Jerome Everson. His show was unbelievably great. Got all these, like he did billboards over on the east side of town and stuff like that, and really interacted with more of the east side community than many of our artists were able to. You know?
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
That was cool. So that stuff is good.
Polly has done so much with the art scene here, and I don't think she fully appreciates what a safe space her home and her influence has been for so many of us. I also lived with Mark and Polly for a couple weeks. When I was home working at the Birchfield.
Oh, that's right.
During grad school.
That's right. Grad school, I remember that.
Yeah.
That's funny. A lot of people have spent time in this house.
A lot of people have spent time in
Jax,
this house.
DeLuca.
Yeah.
Man. And of course,
Jax
Crystal
too.
Sanchez and her girlfriend Megan Bacco. They're both archivists, but one is a preservation archivist and the other is an archivist at the Smithsonian for their collection. But
so cool.
Yeah, very cool. It is. We like having guests. What can I say?
We got the space for it.
We got the space for it now. We didn't have it for the first 15 years because we were in Williamsville and we were all kind of living on. I learned never to buy a cape. Don't buy a cape.
I'll remember remember
they're
that.
Like half houses. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a house and a, or you know, three quarters of a house or something. It's not a full house. No. There's something.
Although for me, I need to start looking into, because of my parents, I finally convinced them that they want to move to Buffalo. Well, they're talking about moving to Buffalo when my dad retires a few years from now.
Oh, uh-huh.
And they want a ranch, and I don't want them. I want, you know, but like a bungalow type thing, something that's all one floor.
Yeah.
You know?
No, that's a good idea. That's why a lot of people move out to it. We did the opposite of what most people do.
Yeah.
That's par for us. That's par for us.
So here's
what
the,
would, yeah, the
here's
finale?
The hard question, or so you thought was the hard question.
Yeah.
From where you are now, and though, so this is the question that really speaks most to me, to the Birchfield, you know, is like articulating needs from the community, and I see the Birchfield as a force within the community that can try and articulate some of those things.
Right.
So for where you're at now, what would help advance your artistic career?
I think at this point, one of the hardest things is finding a gallery outside of Buffalo that would represent you as an artist and sell your work. That is the hardest thing, and that's the thing that would do the most to promote myself as an artist. I mean, it's also kind of curious because having been here now for 25 years, you would think that you would be an established artist, but I still don't feel like an established artist in Buffalo. I'm established as an arts administrator, but a lot of people don't see me as an artist. They see me as this administrator. And that's been a very frustrating thing, and that actually led, that was one of the things that sort of led to me taking this sort of almost sabbatical for 9 months from Hall Walls. And on the other hand, I couldn't really live on what I was making, and so it's good to be able to go back by accident almost. I was actually looking into other possibilities, and I tried the adjunct teaching, and it was just so much work for so little money, like I've already said, that I thought, this sucks, and so I'm not going to do that. I got to do something else. And then it's like, I like kids, I like teaching, but it's hard. It's very, very hard, and there's so much prep that's involved. But to just be actually seen as an artist would be, you know, really delightful. And certain people see me that way, like Tom Holt.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly sees me that way.
Mm-hmm.
And a few people, but, you know, it's kind of like Kyle Butler. I don't even think he knew I was an artist until like a week ago or so when I was talking about 120 paintings sitting in the basement rotting, you know, stuff like that. You know, it's like, you know, they don't always associate the...
But I think that's also like, especially, you know, Kyle Butler and this younger crowd that's coming
right
to Buffalo
that's
for...
moved here from elsewhere.
Right.
They've been so involved in grad school at UB
right
that that's where their energy
right
was. And so they're not paying attention about what's going on in the rest of the community.
Right. And they know
don't
you, but they know you from the Hall
from the
Walls
halls
context.
Thing. Exactly.
You know, and so
exactly
they don't.
Yep.
And
that's
it's it, they don't question.
Right. They don't think about
right
what to do other than that.
Right.
You know, who
but
would,
it's your whole life, right?
Yeah, it's my whole life. I'm sitting at my desk on the computer.
What I love about Buffalo is like you can't throw a rock without hitting an artist in this town. Like I feel like it's safer to assume that everyone's an artist than no one is, you know.
Yeah.
Like even if, I guess my question is, John Massier, does he make art?
He dabbled.
Uh-huh.
But mainly photography.
Yeah.
And he's mainly into like weird, funky images.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I have a piece of his upstairs. He likes not antique, but what do you call it? Classic signs,
mm-hmm,
for instance,
mm-hmm,
like some of the signs out near Eden,
mm-hmm,
or what is that, West Seneca and stuff, where you'll see a diner that still has the sign from the 1930s or 40s, that kind of thing. He really loves that. Or something that's incongruous. Like there's a taxidermied bear with a sign in front of it that says, "Don't pet the bear," or something like that. You know, just like weird sort of social images. And so that's, yeah, he's like, he's, so and he, not unlike Ed, they were both English majors.
Right.
That's what they studied. He became a curator up there at the Jewish Museum in Toronto and did that for, I don't know how long before he started at Hall Walls, but quite a few years. And it's like he almost came to art via music at a certain level. He was a DJ, too, as a young person, a very young person, like teenager almost kind of thing. And he has incredible collection of music and knowledge of musicians and bands and that sort of thing. And having been the visual art curator at the Koffler there in Toronto, I mean, he just sort of had an affinity with that thing. Like you were saying earlier, musicians are artists too. And there is frequently a collaboration between them, just thinking about all the albums that mm-hmm. people used to make, the 30, you know, the big, nice, mm-hmm. beautiful pictures on the 33 RPMs and that kind of thing. And so, and then, you know, Carolyn is kind of a video artist. Mm-hmm. And of course, Steve is consummate musician.
Totally active.
Incredible playing. I can't believe we still have him. I keep thinking somebody's going to snag him over in Copenhagen or mm-hmm. something, and mm-hmm. and he'll be on tour for the rest of his life. You know, so it is kind of like everybody is an artist in a certain extent, and Hallwall still prides itself on that we're an artist-run art center.
Yes.
And Ed still does some writing here and there, like the Spain catalog for the Birchfield.
No.
Yeah, I guess that's, you know, that's my big thing, is that's what people need, is someplace outside of Buffalo. And it's like Nina, I don't know if Nina Freudenheim still does. She used to have connections in mm-hmm. New York. I don't know if she still does or not, but, I mean, she's sort of like the, oh, if you can get into Nina's gallery, then you're a success. It's kind of like, yeah, kind of, mm-hmm. but not really. I mean, she used to show before I moved here. I had met her over the phone and stuff because we were shipping her a Jim Dine print that was really beautiful, big print, like almost 4 by 3 feet or so. And UPS drove a forklift through the print, found it on the floor of their shipping room. So that print's worth more now. But anyway, so of course we had to get it back and then ship it back to and get the insurance involved and all that. It all got worked out. And I think she finally did get that print for some client of hers. But, you know, that's, I don't know how much of that kind of thing she's doing anymore New York. And so, whatever. It's one of those, but she's certainly probably the most respected for-profit gallery, although Benjamin has been here the longest. Yeah. And
it's doing very well for itself.
And so it seems to be doing fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we'll see. We'll see where it goes.
Well, it's
with
an
all
open
these new
opportunity.
Places.
Yeah.
Yep. Exactly.
It's coming. With gentrification comes art galleries.
And more art centers. Yeah. It's like, we're barely surviving. We don't need any more nonprofits.
Right.
You know, there's also that. You can get too many.
Yes.
We need more for-profit galleries
right.
in Buffalo.
Yep.
Of course, there's the new Anna Kaplan BT&C.
Mm-hmm.
And I have never really sat down and talked to her about she's choosing the artists
mm-hmm.
that she's showing and that
she
kind of thing.
She seems like a small stable of artists.
That's what it seems like
Millie
to me.
Chen, Julian, I think Joseph did something there recently, maybe.
Robberly
uh-huh.
Bell.
Yep.
And I forget who else I saw there, but I saw something
right.
up there. Might have even been something of Shasti's.
Tier. You know, I do consider
yeah.
it a...
Yeah, I think that's the intention.
Yeah.
I think that's the intention.
Mm-hmm. Well, here we are at the last question. And this question is sometimes hard for people to answer, but, you know, with where you are, and especially the time that, you know, from the 70s through now, the decades that you've been building your art career and really pursuing that in whatever way you've been doing it, what advice do you have for emerging artists?
I think one thing that's important is also to look at other people's art,
mm-hmm.
to go to the exhibitions. Doesn't mean you have to go to the opening. If you're somebody who's not particularly social, you may want to go at another time when it's not the opening, when you can really look at what's there, instead of just chit-chat with people who are walking by. Keeping a good documentation of your work, which, not that I've always done, but it's something I think that one would be good to start doing as soon as they can. Keeping track of where your stuff is, and if something gets sold, making sure you know who has it, who bought it, that kind of thing. Keeping records, quite frankly, is important, and it makes it so much easier for everything you do as you go along, and you get maybe more interested in your work, and unless you're in that 0.1% or whatever it is that really make it big, then yeah, you can have archivists all over you wanting to do this for you for free, but most of us are never going to be there, and it's better to just you know, keep a record of stuff, even if it's on paper. Mm-hmm. Doesn't have to be all on your computer, but images do have to be digitized at this point, and it's much simpler to keep track of stuff on a computer than on a piece of paper, because it's eventually going to have to get typed into the computer anyway. And so, and get out there, you know, go there, meet people. It's like the AJ method. Mm-hmm. Just go everywhere and tell everybody who you are and how important you are. Which I can't do.
Worked.
Which I can't do. He can do. And guys can do that more easily than women. I only know one woman who's kind of in that vein, and that would be Shasti.
Mm-hmm.
And she's kind of that kind of
assertive.
Tough. A tough assertiveness. Yeah. That I did not, that was not a part of my being. And so that's, you know, that's how it bounces. But whatever. I'm a happy person.
Well, and Polly, you know, sometimes I don't think you give yourself enough credit for the impact you have in this community. And I know it's not the way that you want it, and I can't wait till I make more than I make so that I can take some of your works home, too.
Well, you know, most of my art I have by trading. Very little that I bought.
Tom, too. Yeah.
And Tom, too. Yeah, right. I mean, I have drawers full of stuff that's never been framed from the grad school people that we all traded.
Yeah.
Naked portraits of Mark and I from the waist
up.
They're in a drawer. I found them recently. I went, oh, my God.
I would love to see them.
They're pretty funny.
Well, Polly, here we are.
Here we are.
We're going to go. We're going to end this interview now and go look at Naked from the Waist Up photographs of Mark and Polly.
Not photographs. These are charcoal drawings. Charcoal
drawings.
By Michelle something. Perkins.
Perkins.
I think her name was Perkins.
Well, thank you, Michelle Perkins.
Michelle something. I'll figure it out when we go upstairs.
Well, Polly, thank you so much.
Oh, very welcome.
This
thank
is
you.
Wonderful.
Thank you.